I'm Cory Doctorow, and I write science fiction novels, including a couple set in and around various Disney parks down and out in the Magic Kingdom and Makers, as well as a novella called There's a Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow, Now is the Best Time of Your Life. I'm also an activist and campaigner for copyright reform, and often find myself on the other side of Disney on some of those issues.
Boy, that's a perfect synopsis of everything you're going to say.
Yeah.
Thank you. So I understand you've got a lot of Disney ephemera stocked in your office. Tell me about it.
Oh, goodness. Well, I have many pieces of awesome Disney memorabilia around here. And obviously the most interesting things are the things you're not really supposed to have. So I have a light box with 5 8-millimeter strips of film from the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland, side-sprocketed motion picture film that was used to power the 4 talking heads, singing heads, and the Madame Leota. They used to strike new prints fairly often, and some of the old prints found their way into collector markets. So I've mounted them in a little light box. I've also got a Haunted Mansion greatcoat, uniform greatcoat, as well as a bootleg Madame Leota, bootleg replicas of many of the signs from the Haunted Mansion, and then some of the old 1970s era merchandise from the Haunted Mansion. I also have some of the promotional postcards that they issued when they opened the Pirates of the Caribbean. I have the original Haunted Mansion board game and the Haunted Mansion action figures. I have a stack of 1950s and 60s Disneyland board games, which are notable only for their artwork. The actual gameplay is just dreadful. And I'm sure there's more. You know, it eventually starts to blend in with the background here. But I have my mother's mouse ears from 1955 from Disneyland. We're a multi-generational legacy of Disney aficionados and a Doom Buggy Haunted Mansion license plate. Some of the limited Haunted Mansion leather jackets and things that they've done at various times. A set of shag teacups and saucers that he did for the 50th anniversary of Disneyland, and lots of other bits and pieces.
Are you a collector generally, or is this it?
No, I'm a collector generally. I have an office that's just full of stuff. One of the ways that we've achieved domestic tranquility is by me having an office that's almost as big as our admittedly very small London flat. In which I can keep all of my things where they're not in my wife's way.
Do you remember your first trip to Disney World and or Disneyland?
Well, not really. I was 2 years old the first time I went. My grandparents, as is the destiny of all Ashkenazis from the Northeast, retired to Florida. And on their way to figuring out that they were going to live in Fort Lauderdale, they tried for a year going to Miami. And we went down to visit them at Christmas break and took a trip to Disney World, which I don't remember at all. But by the time I was 6, 1977, my grandparents had settled in a senior's condo called Century Village that my dad always called Cemetery Village. And Century Village was in Lauderdale, and there wasn't really much to do with a six-year-old there. So pretty much as soon as we got there, we rented a car and drove down to Orlando and had an amazing and fateful trip, as it turns out, it had quite a surprising ending that left me, I think, kind of a junkie for Disney parks thereafter after.
Go on.
1977, we went to Disney World, and as you may know, that Disney World in those days had ticket books.
Right.
And so you would buy the tickets by the book. And it was a way of kind of forcing you to go on the sucky rides, you know.
The A, B, C, D, and E rides.
Yeah. And you get B tickets for, you know, horse-drawn carriage down Main Street. Or I think those were actually A tickets. And you know, under any other circumstances, it's pretty unlikely that a kid would go, screw Space Mountain, I want the horse-drawn cart down Main Street.
Yeah.
But when you've got to use up the tickets, you've got to use up the tickets. And in those days, there wasn't as much kind of theme park literacy, I guess you'd call it, such that in those days when they gave you your ticket book, they also gave you a thick book explaining what all the rides were, because it wasn't self-evident that if you said Pirates of the Caribbean is over there, that Pirates of the Caribbean was a dark ride with a waterfall and so on. So they had to actually describe what the rides were, which is quite exciting. And my recollection of that trip is we kept sitting down with that book and deciding what to go on next. And it was this, you know, never-ending calculus of how many tickets of which kind and which rides are there that we could use our tickets on. And so at the very last night, you know, the sun is going down, and we've got one set of e-tickets left, which, you know, you know that my parents were in charge, because if it had been up to me, all the e-tickets would have been gone first. But we had saved one set of e-tickets. And, you know, my folks were going through the book, and my dad said, well, what about this Haunted Mansion thing? And my mom said, well, no, I'm sure Corey is too young to go on the Haunted Mansion. At which point, going on the Haunted Mansion became a matter of, you know, religious significance for me. And so I cajoled them into taking me onto the Haunted Mansion. And it was terrific because the park was about to close. It was quite dark out. There was no one else in the line for the Haunted Mansion except for a pack of, you know, four or five teenagers who I immediately associated with the Scooby-Doo kids. And they were kind of hamming it up and howling along with the wolves. And and my dad was reading the tombstones aloud to me, and I've always been a sucker for, you know, crappy puns. And then the cast member came and flung the doors open and said, Master Gracie requests more bodies. And she was really chewing the scenery. And I just had the best time ever. And 1977 was an absolute golden age of Disney theme park memorabilia, such that when we got off the ride, to the right of where you came off the ride, the left of where you would be if you were queuing up, which was later the start of the queue for the Mike Fink keelboats and now is, I think, largely disused, there was a gift shop. And the gift shop had this spectacular array of things. For one thing, they had this great line in plaster glow-in-the-dark skulls of every description. They also sold a lot of magic tricks and standard gag shop stuff, you know, rubber vomit and so on. They really specialized in things like ghosts that would slide down so-called invisible thread that you could make stop and start by invisibly tightening and loosening the thread that would cause the ghost to stop and start so you could make it sort of dance to your command. What else was there? Glow-in-the-dark fangs, rubber fright masks, really good sculpted rubber fright masks, whole head masks and face masks. And then, you know, the thing that really got me was there were these cards, and they were like the size of a greeting card, but they weren't a fold-over. They're just a piece of card. And then drawn on the card was a caricature of a somewhat sinister-looking Victorian man or woman. And when you exposed the card either to a black light or held it under the light and then moved it into a dark area, and the salesman at the stand had a dark velvet cloth that you could put over all of the glow-in-the-dark things to look at what they looked like in the dark. And when you put these cards in the dark, they glowed with invisible but luminescent and UV-visible paints that turn these Victorian men and women into monsters, vampires and werewolves and Frankenstein's monsters and so on.
That sounds cool.
And they were awesome. So I basically ransomed my mortgage to the year 2080 to buy the shop out. And I was, I think, the happiest six-year-old in the Western Hemisphere. And we took the ferry from the TTC, and we got to the parking lot. We got in the rental car. And I've always been one of those people who immediately falls asleep in cars. There are all these family stories about how I would fall asleep on school buses, and they would miss me when they emptied out the school bus. And I'd ride it all the way to the depot, whereupon the driver would discover me sleeping on a school bench. So I just went straight to sleep. So I don't remember this, but on the way back to Lauderdale, the car broke down. And they had to call Motor Club, and they had to call out the rental agency. The rental agency brought out another car of some kind. And my dad picked me up and transferred me into the back seat of this other car. This was before seatbelts mattered, I guess. And then they drove me back to Lauderdale. And I woke up in the morning in my grandparents' place and said, so where's my Haunted Mansion souvenirs? And they kind of looked at each other and went, oh, the Haunted Mansion souvenirs, which had been left in the other rental car.
Tragedy.
And which were never recovered.
Really?
And with which I have never seen since. Well, some of them I have. I've recovered a number of them in the used market, the collector's market. But those cards, I have had a bookmark search for those cards since eBay was called AuctionWeb. And I have never seen them listed for sale anywhere in the world. And I've only seen them mentioned on one website, on what's now hauntedmansion.com. I used to own that domain, and I gave it to Jeff Baim, who was the guy who runs it, because he had such a great site. So, yeah, that was this momentous, momentous trip.
I have never heard of such a precise, explicit, and life-destroying rosebud moment as that.
Yeah, it's Citizen Kane in Disneyland, all right.
And I'm told that Haunted Mansion, even when you were a young adult and meeting your wife, played a role.
Oh, yeah. Well, I met my wife as an actual adult. But like when I was an adolescent, my Haunted Mansion t-shirt was my lucky t-shirt. I made out with a girl at a party the first time wearing my glow-in-the-dark Haunted Mansion t-shirt. My wife and I, we got married at Casa Loma in Toronto, this weird kind of white elephant of a castle in Toronto that we rented out right around Halloween. And we had a kind of dress-up wedding. And my tux was a Haunted Mansion butler's uniform. I'd been in Mumbai researching a book a little beforehand, and I had a tailor there knock off the Haunted Mansion butler's costume for me. And our wedding march was the Haunted Mansion theme, played by a jazz ensemble that we'd booked out for the evening.
Your love of the Haunted Mansion and Disneyland, Disney World generally, you are a perfect illustration of a hobby horse of mine, which is that starting essentially with baby boomers, as children grew into adults, they never abandoned their childhoods.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. You know, it couldn't be more true of, I guess, a science fiction writer. I mean, being a science fiction writer is a ridiculous career, right? Being a science fiction writer is like growing up to be a cowboy, right? Like, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up, Corey? I'm going to write science fiction stories is a perfectly reasonable answer when you're 6 years old. But it's a strange job for a grown man. I mean, I'm not knocking it. I count my blessings every day here.
So have you been back to Disney World and or Disneyland since you were six?
I've been to all the parks with the exception of Hong Kong, which I didn't go to even though I had the chance because my wife wasn't with me, which is surely an expression of truest love. And my daughter, who's only five, because she traveled with us a lot when she was a baby, has been to all of them except for Hong Kong. So, yes, and we're going to Disneyland on our Easter break in a week, and I'm giving a talk in Paris at an Association for Computing Machinery conference as soon as we get back, and the family's going to come out and join me in Paris for a weekend in Disneyland Paris. So yes, absolutely. I've been to all the parks, lots and lots.
And at this point, is it simply a compulsive thing, or do you enjoy it each time?
No, I genuinely enjoy it, and I enjoy it on a bunch of different levels. So on the one hand, going with a kid is completely different to going as an adult or going as a kid. Going with friends is really different. My wife's in my first serious date. We met at a conference in Finland. When I was living in San Francisco and she was living in London. And our first serious date was she flew over to California. I met her in LA and we spent a weekend in Disneyland together. Going with friends is remarkable, especially taking people for the first time. So that's a very different way of experiencing it. I am one of those people who likes to know how the magic trick is done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate it often on a technical level. And I'm often excited about what I see as the technological mastery on display when I go to the parks. And so that gets better, obviously. I also really like it on a kind of design coherence level. And so seeing how subsequent generations of designers layer on new designs, layer on their interpretation of things, especially now that there's a generation who've grown up on the parks. And so you've got not just people adding to the parks based on their view of the world that isn't the parks and trying to find ways to bring that out in the parks, but you've also got people who are trying to bring out their memories of what the park has been or how the park has meant to them, what the park has meant to them. They're trying to bring that out in the park. So you get things like Trader Sam's opening up, which is, part Adventurers Club from Walt Disney World. This is the Tiki Bar that they've just opened up at Disneyland. Part Adventurers Club, part Trader Vic's, part Tiki Room, all kind of woven together and kind of turned into this thing that is, it's like it's beyond Baudrillardian, right? It's mm-hmm. you know, people throw around the word simulacrum all the time, but this isn't just a simulacrum. This is a simulacrum of a simulacrum. This is like a recreation of a thing that never existed, where that thing that never existed is a recreation of a thing that never existed. And there's something just remarkably satisfyingly meta about that.
Yes. But before it became this self-referential meta thing, now, you know, 58 years into it, what do you think was the kind of original genius of Walt Disney in making Disneyland?
Well, I think the Walt Disney story, the story of the man and his obsessions, is a story about someone who is actually not very happy. It's not controversial to say that Walt Disney struggled with depression and that he had breakdowns and that he was often restless in his life, and whose happiness came from a kind of restless neophilia. He was always seeking out new things to do. And he struggled with the financial side of that. You know, he bankrupted himself when he started out because he really, you know, he didn't want to invent something and then milk it for all the profits he could take out of it. He wanted to invent something and then invent something else, right? He wanted to run a Skunk Works. And his brother, who he brought in to kind of manage the business, wanted to run a business. And I think the genius of Disneyland is that it came out of a Skunk Works project. I mean, he walked out of the company that had his own name on it. He borrowed money. He poached his best staff, right? He poached the best staff out of the studios. And he built a thing that financially shouldn't have worked, that almost didn't work, and that still to this day, I think, is chock-a-block with things that have no good business reason to be there, mm-hmm. but have good mm-hmm. artistic reason to be there. And I think that's kind of the business success, at least for the, you know, if Disneyland has the traditional Pareto distribution, the 20-80 curve, where 80% of its revenue comes from the 20% like me who are just, you know, nuts for it, that's what makes us nuts for it, is all this stuff that you could bring the other 80% through the door without having to do any of it, without having to spend
right.
any of that
money. They give you more than is strictly necessary from a conventional business perspective.
Yeah, Walt called it plussing.
Right. And it seems to me, however, since he almost bankrupted himself more than once, as negative of a figure as his brother Roy is in the story, he probably needed a Roy to keep at least some bounds going and constraints.
Well, this is the deliciousness of the Disney park in a nutshell, is its tension. Tension between commerce and art, tension between storytelling and storytelling as narrative and storytelling as theme, tension between the adult and the childlike. You know, one of the things that Walt set out to do, you know, very famously, was to build a place where kids and grownups could enjoy themselves together. But there's a small set of things that can be enjoyed by kids and grownups together, and oftentimes the way that you make things that kids and grownups can enjoy together is by making things that go over the kids' heads without the kids noticing.
Right.
And that's a kind of tension too. And so, you know, those tensions are what keep the tightrope tight, and they're why Disney seems to go off the rails a lot, and why it's kind of exciting to watch it.
How does it go off the rails?
So Disney goes off the rails a lot. I mean, they bring in crazy ass Roy people who cut the maintenance budget until, you know, as famously happened, the bolts on the holding the big ship that goes around the river shear off, and a cleat tears through the air and decapitates a woman in the middle of a Sunday afternoon. That's kind of a big, going off the rails, literally going off the rails when the Haunted Mansion Space Mountain nearly disintegrated due to a lack of regular maintenance, and they had to shut it down for several years while they refurbished it. Tomorrowland, to quote from the Disney version of Macbeth, one failed rehab after another.
Yeah,
you know, that's what makes it exciting in some ways.
I was surprised in terms of this whole question of, do they spend more than they have to get it so perfectionistically correct to appeal to you Disney freaks, that when I was at Disneyland a few weeks ago and I saw that they were rebuilding, I believe, the mountain in Frontierland and had this giant crane there. And one of the Imagineers that I was with was clearly unhappy that they hadn't convinced the bean counters to paint the yellow construction crane blue or somehow make it disappear or make it Disney-esque. Clearly in that battle, the bean counters had won. The Roys had won.
Yeah, actually, there's a color the Imagineers have called go-away green that all of those nondescript boxes out in the parking lot that you can see on Google Earth that contain the ride mechanisms for the Haunted Mansion are and Indiana Jones and so on, they're all painted go-away green, and I'm sure he would have liked that crane to be painted go-away green.
They talk about, and Walt talked about, the wanting the first Imagineers to create this absolutely immersive experience before immersive experiences were even talked about in that sense, as though in his way of talking about, you're inside a movie. Is that the driving idea, or is that just part of the driving idea? What do you think?
Actually, I think that the real genius of Disney is that it's none of the idea, that it is absolutely nothing like being inside a movie, and it's exactly like being inside a theme park. You know, none of those rides tell a story, and to the extent that they try, they fail, right? All the best things, for example, about the Tower of Terror, which is really one of the most thematically amazing rides they have. All the best things about it are theme, and none of the best things are story.
So it's just theme with spectacular incident.
Yeah, theme with a climax. And you can have thematic tension the same way that you can have narrative tension. You can have escalating thematic tension that kind of reaches a climax and then has a denouement. But there is not a story per se. I mean, you know, and what's interesting about that is that I think it inspires apophenia. I think that we want to impose story on it, and so we end up looking all the closer to try and figure out what the story of the ride is, especially where you have rides that don't have a story that backstops them. You know, the difference between something like Pinocchio and Pirates of the Caribbean. And what's interesting is when you look at the film adaptations of the rides, the ones that are really successful are the ones that really pick up the thematic elements, the design elements, some of the sound design, you know, even replicating some of the effects, but without trying to find story elements per se slavishly pulled out of the so-called plot of the ride. So Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, the most successful film ever adapted from a Disney ride. The least successful films adapted from Disney rides, the Country Bear Jamboree, the Haunted Mansion, are the ones that treated the rides most like stories. And as a result, you were stuck with this very thin material because as a story, it's not much. It's a bit like, you know, there's a thing that you get when you're a novelist, which is people ask you if your books have been made into movies. And, you know, on the one hand, it would be nice to have a giant sack of money, which is what you get if your book is made into a movie. But you can count the number of successful science fiction novel to film adaptations on the fingers of one foot. Because, you know, novels are exactly like novels and almost nothing like films. Even short stories, which are infinitely more adaptable to film than novels, are still usually screwed up when they get adapted for film.
So you're saying Disney invented a new medium and was true to it, and it's sui generis. But what about other immersive experiences? What about massive sporting events or video games? Are they cousins to this?
Well, it's hard for me to comment on sporting events because I'm not a sporty person. But video games are an interesting example. And, you know, this is an area where I think my wife would have more to say than me. She's a former professional gamer. She played Quake for Britain and ran game development for the BBC and Channel 4 for a long time. Really, this is her bailiwick. And she talks about the immersive design of a Disney park in the same way that she talks about the immersive design of World of Warcraft.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's interesting because the thing that keeps you playing World of Warcraft isn't just the design. It's a series of threaded tasks. While you're completing one task, you get tasked with several other tasks that seem like they'd be easy to do on the way, but which always seem to have a few threads sticking out when you finish the first task. So you figure, oh, I'll tidy up those loose threads. And on the way to tidying up those loose threads, you get another task. There's no exact analog to that in the theme park, but what there is in theme parks are weenies, which is, you know, predates theme parks. It's an old carny term for anything that you can see down the midway, that draws you down the midway. And what's interesting about the way that the weenies are revealed, and I think that this is deliberate, is that as you you know, you come into the park and you see your first weenie, and that's the castle at the end of Main Street. And as you're walking towards the weenie, other weenies reveal themselves. And then on the way to the weenies, there are mini weenies, you know, little enticements, whether that's the doors of the shops, which always are open, or food carts or whatever. Or as you go through the some of the best design, which are the little weavy alleyways in the Adventurelands and also New Orleans Square, that also inspires you to go off to one edge.
One of the maybe the key difference between Disneyland and all of the Disneylands and any of their predecessors, carnivals, even World's Fairs, is this sense of and reality of control and perfectionism, and that nothing is almost nothing is left to chance. Clearly, a big reason for their success. As a visitor, does that kind of prisoner-like utopian aspect of Disneyland's ever creep you out, or are you just that's part of what you put up with when you come here?
So there's the authoritarianism chafes, and it particularly chafes when it's done very badly. You know, Disneyland has got some crowd control issues, some capacity issues, particularly when the California Adventure was down for an extended rehabilitation. And as a result, they started to, after a certain hour, create one-way thoroughfares in Tomorrowland or Adventureland and Frontierland, where they would just have cast members with like glowing light sticks, like angry authoritarian ravers, waving them in one direction and just shouting, "Just keep going, keep going!" And that never made me happy. But I actually find that within the constraint, that there's a lot of freedom of action, and that the freedom of action is one of the things that makes that exploring the freedom of action is one of the things that makes it kind of exciting. You know, there's this idea in video games of speed running the video game. You know, you see people speed running Mario. How quickly can you solve all of Mario?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like speed running Disney parks. You know, on a good day, I can go to all of the e-ticket rides and then basically every other ride that I like and every show that I like in California Adventure and Disneyland Park. So it's a bit like writing haiku or a sonnet, you know, having this constrained range, and then within it having a lot of freedom. And you know, when you see people finding self-expressive mechanisms within that, they're all the more sweeter for their rarity or for the difficulty they've overcome, or the, you know, just like when you see people in video games doing extraordinary things. You know, there were gold farmers in Warcraft. These are people who illegally sell in-game gold. Mm-hmm. They pay kids in South Asia or Southeast Asia to do continuous low-grade monster killing, build up huge piles of gold, and then sell them to Westerners who don't want to have to faff around doing it. And at one point, these gold farmers made an ad for their services by killing a bunch of crappy monsters and spelling out their services and corpses. And there's something great when you see that. And there was a point at which at the bottom of Splash Mountain in Disneyland, there was a rock that everybody stuck their gum on. And it was like this bizarre gum sculpture at the bottom of Splash Mountain. And there was something great about it in its incongruity. And, you know, speed running Disneyland, finding the ways through that nobody knows about, finding the secrets that nobody knows about, all of that stuff gives it a real game-like element.
Like, what's a secret that you know about that most people don't know about?
Oh, goodness. Well, so there's, if you're on the train, there's a couple of spots where you can see the places where they set up the rooftop surveillance on Main Street.
Uh-huh.
So you can see like the cops with the scopes up on the roofs on Main Street. I've got a couple of good pictures of that.
Huh.
What else?
So kind of a Stasi tour of Disneyland.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, and stuff like there's you know, one of the geese from the America Sings attraction, robotic geese, has been turned into a Star Tours robot by the simple expedient of removing all of its flesh. And so, and all you can, the only, the tell is that it's got robot goose feet. And so when you go through Star Tours queue area, you can sort of point it out and you see the robot that looks a bit like a goose. Yes. That used to be a singing goose in America Sings.
Do you have strong feelings about Disney World versus Disneyland versus Paris versus Tokyo?
Well, I mean, obviously the charm of Disneyland is the constraint that they labored under, especially in the early years. And so it's all much more compact. There's a lot more optical illusions. There's a lot more kind of things wedged into the cracks between things. And so it's there's a British term, dinky, that means the opposite of what it means in America. Dinky here means like cute and small and just sweet. And Disneyland is very dinky. Disney World, on the other hand, has many advantages. On the one hand, it's got scale and just the sheer volume of things that you can do, and that sort of a splendid isolation from the rest of the world. The illusion is much more complete. But the other thing about it is that because it's staffed largely by people who have come from away to work there, and it's attended mostly by people who've come from away to attend it, there is a greater sense of unreality overall. Disney World is not the weekend job for bored teenagers from Orange County. Disney World is a job that you move to Central Florida to take. And so there's a certain immersiveness to it. Well, Paris is certainly still finding its way. My kid brother calls it Disneyland Russia. It's just sort of, you know, long queues, chain smoking, queue barging, spectacular rudeness, but on the part of the staff. We bought a overpriced Minnie Mouse spoon when I took my daughter there when she was like 2 years old, and it broke as soon as we took it out of the packet. But I didn't have the receipt, and I brought it back to the shop, and the lady said, "Well, without the receipt, I can't refund your money or give you an exchange. Perhaps you stole it."
not the best cast member, perhaps.
Yeah.
Or she was playing the French cast member.
That's right. She was role playing French. Tokyo Magic Kingdom is a pretty thorough carbon copy of Florida, but Tokyo Disney Sea is the single most beautiful built environment I've ever been in. There is nothing like it anywhere on Earth, and it has almost no play value. The rides are okay. They're not spectacular. But as a series of well-wrought vistas that blend very smoothly into one another and that are extremely well conceived of and beautifully executed and spectacularly maintained and thoughtfully done, Disney Sea is like nothing else.
How Japanese of them.
Yeah, seriously. Plus they have cappuccino-flavored popcorn.
Wow. You made Disney World the setting for your very first novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. Was that just inevitable given your lifelong obsession?
Well, a little bit, sure. I mean, I think that so the first time I went to Burning Man, my friend Catherine said, this is what a post-scarcity society would be like, right? If you didn't have to work, what would you do to demonstrate or to kill time, right? To celebrate or explore your world, to delight your fellow human. And I think that Disney World is another example of what we might do if we were free from constraint and want. It's the kind of giant weird toy that represents operation in a condition of non-scarcity. You know, and it's not a coincidence that it's largely a playground for the rich, right?
That the Disney parks are playgrounds for the rich?
Well, certainly they're not playgrounds for the poor. You know, while there are, you know, families, working class families that save up to go every 10 years mm-hmm. to Disney, their bread and butter are people who are paying serious money to go to Disney mm-hmm. World. And they, you know, one of the things that they did recently in California was double the price of an annual pass, which was really the working person's, you know, the California annual pass, which is really the working person's way to get into Disneyland. And they had no drop off at all in attendance, which tells you something about the price sensitivity of the people who were buying or in purchases, rather. It tells you something about the lack of price sensitivity in the audience, the actual audience for those annual passes.
Or the addictive quality to all these Cory Doctorows who are out there in the world who must have their Disney fixes.
I guess that's possible. Yeah, sure. Although, you know, when I graduated when I got out of university, I never graduated, but when I got out of university and didn't have any money, I went to Disney like every 5 years. And it wasn't until I had regular work and money in my pocket, and then later when I lived in California, that going to Disneyland became a very regular thing.
Your pleasure in the Disney parks is, as I would expect, this interesting combination of absolutely enthusiastic and sincere and, of course, ironic and bemused. Has that always been the case?
I would not say by and large that it's ironic. I think ironic implies a certain... So it's detached in the sense that it's critical and technical, but it's not ironic. It's not like, oh, isn't it a bit silly? Like, isn't this all a bit kitschy? Like, what a great in-joke this Disney park is. It's more like, what an amazing and fascinating contradiction that a thing built this well, and for what I think in Walt's case was a fairly noble purpose. And I think Walt was never just about separating marks from money. I think that he really,
right,
he had in mind a certain perfection.
Right.
You know, isn't it great on its face?
Right. Intellectuals, progressives, all those kinds of people have always, from its beginning, hated on Disneyland and the Disney World. But one thing, spending time there a lot myself and recently, is how amazingly ahead of its time in an urban planning sense Disneyland was, to have these pedestrian streets, these small-scale shops, this greenery, you know, as a response at the time to suddenly sprawling, soulless American suburbs. It reminds me of what, you know, Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown said about Las Vegas. It's almost all right. It doesn't really get credit for being a progressive prototype of how towns can be and neighborhoods can be.
Well, you know, in the defense of people who criticize the urban planning sensibilities of the Disney Corporation, Walt's plan for the experimental prototype city of tomorrow, Epcot, was a horrific garden city with very strict zoning rules, a kind of condo association from hell.
Yes.
And ironically, instead, they ended up building Celebration, which at least at its peak was, you know, a kind of Jane Jacobs complete new town. So it's a bit of a mixed bag on that score.
Of course
I don't know that they set out to create that kind of livable city. I think to the extent that they were working under conditions of constraint, that there was only so much Orange Orchard they could buy in Orange County.
Right.
And if they could have bought more, they would have sprawled like they did in Florida.
Right. No, but I guess I mean that not intentionally, but in the from late 50s and the 60s, as North Americans were losing the idea of shopping on main streets and walking around and having charm in their real lives, Disneyland became a kind of living model. I mean, a weird artificial living model of what living in a town or city could be like.
Well, yes, but you could say the same thing about every big mall.
But malls depress me. Disneyland doesn't.
There are those malls in LA. I forget what they're called. The ones that are like little fake towns.
The one off Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. Yes.
Yeah. There's a couple. They just built another one, I think, up in Glendale, and they've got trolley cars.
Yes, exactly. And which clearly wouldn't exist. I mean, exist along a lineage from Disneyland.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they represent kind of what you do after the malls, after the commercial real estate market bubble pops, and you know, the mall starts to go away as a destination. What do you do to make them more destination like? And you know, the best of them, they've got farmers markets and so on.
Right.
You know, and it's funny because when you talk to the Walt people about their hilarious term for it, merchantainment, which is merchandise entertainment. They will be very passionate on the subject of Disney making bespoke objects, commercial objects, that are not just things that you can buy in a mall, nor are they things that you can buy in a mall with a thing that you can't buy in a mall sewn onto them like a badge.
A large part of your life has been as an activist on behalf of making information free, not having copyrights be restrictive. The Disney Corporation, obviously, is one of the great Satans in your fight. Is that a contradiction you're comfortable with?
Well, certainly. For one thing, I think it's perfectly possible to hate the sinner and love the sin. I mean, you know, if you could only love artists who were good, we'd have to throw out Tolstoy and lots of other, you know, writers and painters who were, you know, womanizers and jerks and drug addicts and violent. And Groucho Marx somehow found it in his heart to enjoy the company of T.S. Eliot, who was a vicious anti-Semite. You know, so mm-hmm. it's possible to like good art even when it's made by bad people. And it's possible to be a good artist and a bad person. And I think that the art that Disney Corporation is often a bad person, but it very often produces very good art. That said, I think the other reason, if you are someone who believes in remixes and in the public domain, the other reason to like Disney is because Disney is such a prolific remixer and user of the public domain. If you ever needed a poster child for the idea that good art can come out of the public domain and out of remixing, Disney is it.
What, they didn't invent Pinocchio and Snow White, you're telling me?
Yeah. Well, exactly. But even more so, you know, I actually own the domain enchantedtikiroom.com, and it's one of the domains that I've owned forever and ever and never figured out quite what to do with. But in my kind of ideal world, I would have a video of the original show as it opened in the 1960s in Disneyland. And I would periodically step out into this video with like a long you know, professor's baton and rap on various elements of the ride and explain how that they are references to popular culture that were imported without permission, you know, from the Hawaiian war chant to the, you know, the Jacques Brel parrot who's singing and the Louis Armstrong impression and so on. And how the thing that made that such a successful attraction was taking without permission.
Right. So once we swipe it, you can't swipe it from us.
Yeah, well, every pirate wants to be an admiral, right? and everybody thinks that what they have made is a precious snowflake, and what they made it out of is plumbing. And so that's true, but it's also true that every precious snowflake eventually kind of piles up with all the other precious snowflakes and becomes a glacier that's just something that people just come along and stand on without thinking much about the precious snowflakes that make it up. You know, when Poe invented the detective story, I'm sure that he believed that what he had made was a unique and wonderful creation of his own particular circumstances and imagination. And I think Poe is a hell of a writer. I named my daughter Posey for Edgar Allan Poe. And so, you know, I would be the last person to slight Poe. And I think what he made was an amazing thing. I also think that it's plumbing. Right, I think that all those detective stories that came afterwards, while they owe some kind of technical debt to Poe, that it's not a debt that even needs to be acknowledged. I don't fault Carl Hiaasen for not having an Edgar Allan Poe-style detective mystery emblazoned on the cover of his books.
So we don't stand on the shoulders of giants; we stand on the wrecked plumbing of our predecessors.
It's not wrecked plumbing; it's just plumbing.
Yeah.
Right? Eventually the origin of these inventions, their creative origins, become first a curiosity and then a thing that we forget about altogether. You know, there would have been quite some period where every time someone used a flush toilet, they would have thanked John Crapper for his remarkable invention. And these days, it's just the toilet.
Yeah. You grew up in Canada. You are now a British citizen. So as both a close student of Disneyland's and not an American. Are there American ideas, values, inclinations that are most embodied in the Disney parks?
Are there American ideas? Well, I'll tell you the American idea that I wish was more embodied in the park, when you go through the all of the most patriotic bits of Disney World, especially, because that's the one with the America Pavilion and so on, although, you know, Disneyland has got the Lincoln stuff. What's missing from all of that is the Bill of Rights. What's there is like the great man theory of history and lots of executive power And what's missing is all of the stuff about fundamental freedoms, which is, I think, one of America's great gifts to the world. You know, there people get arrested in totalitarian societies, and they've watched so many American movies that they demand their Miranda warning. You know, that it has become normalized all over the world, the idea of fundamental rights that have some of the most popular expression in the Bill of Rights. Are there American values that shine through? Yeah, some admirable, some less than admirable. Certainly, at their worst, the parks are a shrine to high fructose corn syrup and intense carbohydrate loading. And, you know, I say that because it's slightly funny, but it's actually a challenge to eat well in the parks. And my wife and I both lost a lot of weight. I lost over 100 pounds by giving up carbs. And, you know, it's hard to go around the parks.
Another thing that I noticed and I'd never thought about or noticed before, but when I was there last month, I noticed that for all of its evocations of Main Street, old-time America, and everything else, the lack of any religious iconography or fake church or any of that stuff is, if you're trying to replicate some simulacrum of America, is an interesting gap. Of course, it has to be there as a gap, but it's an un-American aspect.
Yeah, you're right. I've never thought of that as both an atheist and a dirty foreigner. You know, I'd never noticed the absence of the church. I think my eye would have slid right past it in any event. So I'm not surprised. And you know, in some ways, the in Florida, particularly, the Disney organization embodies some very progressive values. They're I don't know if it's still true, but they were for a long time the largest employer of gay and lesbians in the Southland, and one of the first companies, major companies, to extend same-sex benefits.
Right. Do you expect you'll keep going back over and over to various Disney theme parks as they take over China and the rest of the world for the rest of your life?
Yes, although I don't know. I mean, I find it hard to imagine, having been to Shanghai, that if I went back to Shanghai, that I would spare more than a day for a Disney park there, because Shanghai's got an awful lot to do. It's a bit like Tokyo. Yes, going out, you know, dragging my butt out to Chiba for a day to go to Tokyo Disney Sea is well worth it. But if I have 4 days in Japan, I really want to spend 4 days. 4 days is barely enough to do, you know, to scratch the surface of Tokyo, let alone get around to the rest of the country. The most I've ever spent at Tokyo Disneyland was when we were there because my wife was speaking at the Tokyo Game Show and I was with our daughter. And so we had to go out to Chiba every day anyway, because that's where the big conference center is. And so just down the road was Tokyo Disney Sea. And so I just brought the baby over there every day and hung out there, because it was more fun than hanging out in a giant convention center. But if they build Disney parks in places where I have to go for work, where there's not much else to do, if they built a Disney park in Vegas, which frankly, you know, I can entertain myself in Vegas for about a day, after at which point I become just terminally bored. You know, once you've seen Penn and Teller and eaten a really good steak, if you're not gambling or looking to have sex with a prostitute and you're on your own in Vegas, there's not much to do.
Right. Corey, thank you so much. This was great.
Cool beans. Thanks.